It's Open Call with Eric and Chris.
That's me.
It's a show that you'll never want to miss. It's Open Call.
It's Open Call. I'm Chris Grace.
And I'm Eric Michaud.
And today is Monday, April 29th, 2019. Do you know where your Broadway plays are?
They're in New York.
They're mostly in New York. Some of them go on tour.
They do. Speaking of which.
Right into the Broadway news.
Oh, I thought we were going to jump right in talking about the tour that we just saw. Not a whole lot of news this week, but I did want to pay tribute to the passing of Jo Sullivan Lesser. She's a theater actress, the widow of Frank Lesser, the lyricist and writer. She was nominated for a Tony for The Most Happy Fella. She was 91. She died of heart failure. In other news, today is the 12th anniversary of the opening of Legally Blonde, the musical on Broadway.
Wow.
I know, it's crazy that it's been 12 years.
I guess.
It doesn't seem like it's that old of a show already.
Uh-huh.
And also, I was working at Telsey when it was running, so it's weird to think that it's been that long since I was working at, or since I was at Telsey.
Mm-hmm.
And also that long since I was in New York. Wow. They just announced that Bandstand, the musical from 2017 that had a short run with Corey Cott and Laura Osnes, is going to go on a national tour. It will be a non-equity national tour, but it will be a tour nonetheless, that's going to launch this fall. There's been no announcement of cast. Obviously, they haven't cast yet. But they've also kind of not really officially said if it's going to be the same direction and choreography. I'm assuming it will be, but who knows?
Weird that they're not really striking while the iron is hot with that.
I think they're kind of playing up on, because it was filmed for like the Fathom Events things. And I think it got some more recognition and more people saw it because of that.
It's just
and
odd.
So, no,
yeah. It's just odd to wait, like,
2 years.
2 years until no one's really thinking. It's not like it I don't think it won anything, did
it? No, it didn't.
So,
and it had a very short run.
Anyway, well, speaking of non-equity, I think we might have said that the band's visit was a non-equity tour at some point.
Uh-huh.
But apparently it's not.
Hooray.
You read on Playbill
today.
So, I mean, I'm pretty sure that I read that it was non-equity at some point. So I'm wondering if they tried to go non-equity and then we're not able to cast it equity. Well, anyway, I guess it's good news.
It's certainly better news for the performances that were going to be necessary to make the show work.
Yeah. It's just performance unions is always a strange thing. I feel like if we were in a automotive plant, we would be like, unions are definitely good for us.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like right now there's a lot of stuff going on with the WGA, which is the union for screenwriters. And there's a lot of thought about, like, is this the thing that's actually good for us or not? So I don't know. Yeah. I mean, generally, I guess it's good. Actually, a famous person from theater, John Robin Bates, who wrote The Substance of Fire, is one of the few like prominent writers to like kind of come out against the union.
Yeah, he's like holding out, right?
Yeah, and he's he wrote a public letter about why he doesn't kind of agree with what the union is doing, and I think he's refusing to do what the union has told. They've told all the writers that they have to fire their agents.
Right.
I think he's refusing to do it.
I'm pretty sure, I believe I read that as well, that he is refusing to do that.
So, and he is getting dragged, as they say.
Yeah, as the kids say.
I would say rightfully so, because his letter is pretty crappy. You can Google it.
Mm-hmm.
But so, that means next year when we see Band's Visit, we will be seeing an equity cast.
Mm-hmm. And this is not to say, I mean, I'm not certainly not putting down non-equity actors, and I'm certainly not putting down non-equity tours. It's what you and I have talked about, I don't think ever on here before, but at least we've discussed it in our own lives, that to find an actress capable of doing that role, the role of Dina, who's that age, who is still non-equity, is difficult.
Yeah.
I think to bring the level of craft to it is difficult, because at that point, if you've reached that point in your career where you're able to successfully do that, you probably would have joined equity by now.
Yeah.
So it's kind of hard to, I'm not putting down non-equity actors. I'm just saying that there comes a point where you reach a point in your career where you want to go professional, and there's a reason for that.
Well, I mean, you're professional if you're non-equity, but like if you were good over into your 40s and 50s, it would be it would have to be a very conscious choice to continuously turn down opportunities to join the union.
Right.
The only thing maybe would be if somebody was in the union and sort of fell out of acting and was coming back into it and like let their union membership lapse or something like that.
Right.
But still, that's very rare. Mm-hmm. Overall, I'm not sure how to feel about equity in general. I feel like it's such a, I feel like I hear as many times when people are missing chances to work as they are. In LA, we have 99 seat theaters, and they kind of, they at least made a choice about that 99 seat theater seating plan that the majority of LA actors were not in favor of,
right.
Which is now if you do a 99 seat theater show, you have to pay the actors minimum wage for the rehearsals and for the performances, which doesn't seem like a lot, except most of the time before it was people were volunteering their time. And so now it just raises your bottom line for doing even a small like showcase to a pretty high number. And considering that, I think there's limits on how expensive the tickets can be for a 99 seat plan.
Right.
It from a producer point of view, it leaves a very small margin of error to try to make money.
Right.
Or even break even.
Right. Which makes producers not want to do it.
Yeah.
So then there's less work.
Yeah. I would love it if someone had done a study. That's what they said would happen if this plan went through. It went through like about 18 months ago. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if actually that's true or not, that those have gone away. I have a feeling there's more productions now that are just like on the down low.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, I think that's exactly what's happening, is that there's a lot of equity work out, or equity actors out here who are doing non-equity work under the radar. But also I think, you know, it used to be like, you know, you're not paid for rehearsals, but you'll get $50 a show type of thing, which ends up being more than you would be making in an equity show.
Right. Because now it's $13
an hour. And if your show's an hour and a half, you're making what, $20 for that show before taxes and union fees. So it's like, it's we shot ourselves in the foot with this, I think,
or
equity shot us in the foot. And there have been a lot of instances where it's like, there's a show going out. Why is the Newsies national tour non-equity?
Yeah.
There's no reason for it other than Disney has a lot of money and power.
For the LA stuff, like, I don't actually know what the answer is, because neither of us were here doing LA theater when this was in discussion, but the LA theater community very clearly said that they were against the equity plans. Mm-hmm. So that to me takes a lot of balls to be like, we're an organization that's pretty much based in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to come to your region and change a policy that you have for your city against the wishes of all the actors in your city.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
It's kind of, I mean, I kind of equate it to the Methodist Church when they went, they did their whole LGBT vote, and, you know, people in the States were up in arms about it because they were like, this is not our values. This is not how we feel.
Yeah.
And you're making decisions that are affecting us directly.
Yeah.
I equate it kind of the same idea.
At this level, at the, you know, no one in, very few people in Los Angeles are just, I'd say almost nobody is just doing theater, making a living. I can't imagine anyone's doing
that.
So in LA, a lot of the people that are acting in shows, writing in shows, directing them and producing them are sort of overlapping. I bet most of the producers are actors as well.
Sure.
So there's not really a, especially at that level, 99 seats, there's not like greedy producers wanting to exploit actors to make $100,000 on a show.
Right.
It's like we want to act in between gigs.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like, if by putting this plan in, basically it just means like, well, I guess I'm just not going to act for these 3 months.
Right.
As opposed to like, oh, now all the jobs pay really well or something, you know?
Right. Instead of like trying to do a showcase or trying to do a small show and, or make, create your own work or make your own art, you can't.
And the thing is like I'm doing a, small, short film shoot this weekend. And similarly, you want to try to go by the book. So they're doing, it's a SAG, Screen Actors Guild, SAG, like low budget indie contract or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they had problems getting it all set up because they got kind of hassled by their rep from SAG about doing a read through and all this stuff. And they were just having some issues that the whole thing almost got pushed back by a month because they didn't get it all. They got it all cleared like Thursday night.
Wow.
To start shooting on Saturday.
Wow.
And they were kind of like, well, this is what we get for trying to go by the book.
Right.
We could have just shot this without any, you know, we just all get together on the weekend and just shoot it.
Right.
And no one would know.
Right.
So it's weird. I feel like at the lowest levels, it's like the unions should be a little more encouraging of like getting work done and, you know,
allowing people to do their craft and create things without having to necessarily jump over these hurdles.
Yeah. And then like
they're putting in place.
And then for Avengers Endgame or Book of Mormon, that's when they should be collecting tons of dues and fees mm-hmm. and stuff that helps sustain the rest of the union.
Right.
As opposed to like putting all this effort, kind of hassling the like lowest 10% income earners of your union.
Right. Make the Newsies National Tour an equity tour and get the dues and everything off of them.
So
rather than letting Disney bully you and push you around and say, oh, okay, you can do the Alort contract or whatever, even though your show was never slated to come to Broadway in the first place and then made a shit ton of money.
Oh, I don't think I mentioned this on the podcast, but the Ink show that I auditioned for, which is on Broadway, it's at the Manhattan Theater Club, is a Lort contract. It's a Lort A. I think it's called Lort A plus.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the best Lort contract you can get, but it's not a Broadway contract.
Right.
So it's, I looked it up and it was like $9.90 a week or mm-hmm. something like that.
Which is like, it's a little more than half.
Yeah, because
for a contract, the last time I looked, a chorus contract in a Broadway show was like $15.60 something.
Yeah, I was just looking at the listing for the Band's Visit Replacements that I was, because we were Googling around looking for stuff, was $2,000 a week.
Okay. So you're making less than half, yet they're still eligible for Tonys. They're still eligible to be considered a Broadway show.
Yeah.
That's shitty.
So
Roundabout does the same thing. Roundabout was put in place. They were offered Lort contracts in place to get them to start, you know, as a startup.
Right.
Well, they've been producing for over 20 years on Broadway. It's time to revoke that and make them pay their actors what they're earning.
And the shitty. So there's like four or five theaters that get it, but also Lincoln Center gets this.
Yeah.
Which is crazy. They can afford to pay their actors.
Right. Well, then they'll start being like, well, we're going to have to reduce the size of our orchestras, or we're going to have to reduce the size of this or that. Yeah.
But I mean, that's just, I don't fault those, I believe those are all nonprofits.
Mm-hmm.
I don't fault them for trying to get as low a price as they can.
Sure. But
equity should kind of be like, that's where you want equity to be to enforce a little more. Because it's, I think, for a Broadway performer to be making $1,000 a week is maybe like, so what's that? $1,000 a week would be $52,000 a year. That's really not enough to live in New York City.
No.
So I don't know. For to be in a production at theoretically the top tier mm-hmm. of the industry, like there isn't a higher industry than like there's not a more prestigious place in America to do theater
than Broadway. Correct.
So I feel like you should be getting the top contract.
Right.
So those are the cases where like. Equity can't make Disney do Newsies as an equity tour, but there's a lot of places where it seems like either they could be stricter with people at like high-end commercial productions, or they could work in partnership with other unions, I would hope. I actually don't know what the other union, I don't know what a stage director union, what if there is one, or if there's a choreographer's union. There probably isn't one, right? Mm-hmm. So... But like we mentioned before that like when Bullets Over Broadway toured, it was non-equity
mm-hmm.
and they were using Susan Stroman's direction and choreography.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like she's probably a member of equity.
She absolutely
is. I mean, I would say there probably should be some kind of reprimand.
Right. That's what I'm saying. Like if. You know, Roundabout says, we don't want to do anything more than a Lort contract, then, okay, you're no longer eligible for Tony Awards.
Yeah.
That's it. It's one or the other. You cannot be producing on Broadway,
yeah,
paying your actors less than everyone else is paying, and still be eligible for all the same perks.
So the thing about it being, but that's not them either. So they'd have to go to, that's what I mean, they'd have to go to, like, the Antoinette Perry
right.
Association.
But I kind of think that they would be on board with it.
I don't think so, because I'm assuming that organization... The Tonys are essentially a marketing device.
It's a commercial.
I'm sure that it was created by producers.
Sure.
So there's no reason that they're going to be like, you know, they don't give a shit.
Yeah.
Producers, just, you know.
It's just frustrating when you have a non-profit theater or not-for-profit theater producing the revival of Cabaret that runs for 6 years on Broadway.
Yeah.
Charging full price.
Yeah.
Full Broadway prices. And you're going to tell me that didn't turn a profit? I'm sure it did.
Especially a place like Roundabout where I can almost even, for this Ink show, like it's new to America. It's a new work.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like the production is a little bit more ambitious. So mm-hmm. maybe you can say like actually that seems, it's a short run. It closes in June.
Mm-hmm.
So that seems like, what you want a nonprofit theater. That's the kind of work you want them to put up.
Right.
Whereas like Roundabout does like 12 Angry Men.
Right.
You know, and it's like...
Or She Loves Me.
Right. So it's... Roundabout doesn't feel like it's on some artistic...
Like mission?
Yeah, in the same way that some of the other places... Even Lincoln Center. Like, Lincoln Center does do some more ambitious...
Sure.
Is that where we saw Oslo?
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah. We saw the best play Pulitzer winner, and those actors were making Lort contracts.
Right.
That's terrible.
It is terrible. It's very frustrating to me. Because it feels wholly unfair, and it feels like, if I were a producer who wasn't involved in one of those theaters, I would be screaming my head off. I'd be like, why am I paying this actor twice as much as you are, and we're eligible for the same awards? Why?
Right. It doesn't feel unfair to me. It just feels like particularly frustrating when it seems like equity is willing to throw their weight around when it comes to low-end actors.
Yeah.
And... doesn't feel like the WGA asking writers to all fire their agents. They've asked them to fire agents, particularly at these big four agencies, CAA, UTA, William Morris, and I think one other one, Innovative, no. ICM. And that's a big move, negotiating move.
Yeah.
And like a bunch of like thousands of writers have fired their agents.
Mm-hmm.
So that feels like, whether or not you think it's too hardcore, it feels like your union is like really like doing something.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I'm not sure what the big equity, you know, like the WGA and SAG like threaten to strike every like 3 years
mm-hmm.
and have.
Mm-hmm.
Like when's the last equity strike?
We walked out with the musicians union a few years ago.
Yeah, but like a primary thing for equity.
Yeah,
when
it's been a while.
I don't think they've even gotten close to like threatening a strike.
Yeah,
well, and there's probably things to strike over.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, Spider-Man alone should have had people striking.
Yeah,
people were getting injured on that show left and right.
Well, like so for Disney's equity, non-equity tour of Newsies, do they put out a do not work for that?
Yeah,
because. I feel like they don't put out do not work for everything. I feel like do not work is, if you go to Equity's website, there's a thing that says do not work for these productions because they're not equity or whatever.
And also I think, well, do you get on the do not work list because you tried to hire
equity? Maybe, yeah. Because what I'm saying is I bet Newsies was not on that because that tends to have a little bit of a like a scarlet letter.
Like a shaming.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because like 50 Shades in Vegas was on that list for a while.
In Vegas, I believe it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
But never the tour. I mean, that's the other thing is like we toured.
This is 50 Shades, the musical parody.
50 Shades, the musical parody. We toured like they toured for like 18 months or something like that. And right. It was off Broadway for 9 months.
Uh-huh.
And
it was never.
As far as I know, I don't think there was ever an equity inquiry to it, which is odd. Because like if you're doing a show for 9 months in New York City, probably pretty close to the equity office.
Right.
And also in a space where like Silence the Musical had been. And mm-hmm. so it was like, it's not like a hidden theater.
Right.
By the way, because we were non-equity, we were not eligible for, whatever the off-Broadway
OBs.
Yeah.
Yeah.
OBs are specifically for equity.
Well, that's what I was thinking because you had mentioned that this is kind of going off topic, but you had mentioned that Voldemort, the show that you're producing in London will be
British union, equity. Yeah.
British equity, which means it will be eligible for Olivier's.
Oh, I guess, yeah. I mean, the British theater scene, I don't know anything about the economics, but it seems way more amenable to just creating stuff because mm-hmm. the Voldemort will be at an off West End theater for 3 weeks And I can't remember what the rental is, but the rental is very inexpensive compared to New York or even LA. And the we're going to have to pay British equity minimums for this, but the minimum is you know, a lot less than it would be in New York.
Yeah, you're not paying us $2,000 a week.
No.
No matter how much we deserve it.
Yeah. to be fair, I was putting together sides for people to audition for this. By the way, if you're listening to this in London, the UK, or Edinburgh, or you're going to be at Scotland Fringe this year and you want to audition, we're going to be putting up casting notices for those parts. There's five parts available in our show. Because the parts where Americans are not returning, we're going to cast with UK actors. But putting the sides together was not the easiest thing. Because some of the parts really don't, like, some of the parts don't have that many lines.
Right.
So, in a way, I'm like, I'm not paying you $2,000 a week to say eight lines and sing one song. No, like, there's actually, there's a couple of the characters where it's like, it was, I had to, like, Frankenstein
stuff
together. To even get one page of a scene with another character, I had to, like, stitch stuff together.
Wow.
So, anyway, that's all good for Ben's visit.
Yeah. That was a really long tangent that we just
I don't know what the real solution is. I know that I don't think, at least I'm reluctant to think that producers are really like evil producers trying to like exploit actors all the time. And I'm sure people at Equity are just doing their best.
Mm-hmm.
But it feels a little bit like Equity isn't a particularly powerful union, and that it's more often than not at the like lower classes of actors kind of gets in the way of people working.
Yeah.
Because it seems like I almost feel like if you're like, if a non-Equity production of something you wanted to, of City of Angels or whatever, was around the corner from us, it feels like you should be able to do that show if you want to. I know that their theory is that it hurts the union.
Yeah. There should be an option. Like, even if it's a, you know, twice yearly option that every Equity actor can take two non-union jobs per year or something like that, just to, because you have to keep in shape, you have to keep your muscles.
Yeah.
You have to keep that exercised, that being on stage. And if you aren't doing that because you can't work because of your union, then how are you improving as a performer? You can take every class in the world.
Yeah.
You can do every vocal coach that you want, but unless you're performing, you're not exercising your craft.
Now, it's possible that there's some, I know that there's contracts where you can have like two Equity people, like when we saw Carolina Change in Chicago,
artist.
The one person was Equity and the rest was not.
Which is great if you're the type for the lead.
Well, also the I think it might also be an issue of, again, me, I only just I know this is obvious, but I only just realized that theater, because theater is not a mass medium. And the tension of a union based in New York City regulating an industry that sort of emanates out of New York City, but then in every other city is very different.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, Screen Actors Guild sort of faces the same issue because, you know, a lot of movies come out of Hollywood, but there's also other cities like Atlanta and Chicago and stuff that New York that produce stuff. But I don't think that the mechanisms and economics of how film works in Chicago and New York is so different from Los Angeles.
Right.
Whereas the way theater works in Los Angeles is extremely different than New York.
Mm-hmm.
And the way theater works in Chicago, I assume, is extremely different than New York. So maybe it's coming from the fact that it's hard to set rules for all of these different microcosms.
Right. And there are regional offices. Like there's an LA branch of Equity that kind of oversees and, you know, reports back to New York. But
I think it's more... I'm assuming it's really imbalanced.
Yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that as much as we say, you know, as much as LA Equity says like this isn't working or this is not how it works, New York or, you know, the upper management of Equity can only, unless you're in it, you don't necessarily see how it's working or necessarily know how it's working unless you're here doing it.
Yeah.
So
we'll see. Like I wonder what effect it'll have, because there's a fair number of shows that have gone to Broadway that were basically little workshops in Los Angeles.
Yeah, Dress a Chaperone, kind of.
Was that a wedding out here?
I think it was in Canada, but then the Amundsen, I think, was the first theater to produce it.
Uh-huh.
Was out here in LA.
I believe Heather started out here. I believe we've read a lot of things where it'd be like, well, this debuted at the Pasadena Playhouse.
Yeah. Or the Amundsen a lot of times too.
When we were at the Amundsen last week, Burn This started here.
Uh-huh. The Kerry Russell one?
No, the original.
Oh, the original.
Okay. The Malkovich one.
Gotcha.
Like there's a lot of original work that that starts on the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, like Des Makanoff, his theater, I forget what theater he was. He with La Mirada?
La Jolla,
maybe? La Jolla, thank you. Yeah. La Jolla. That's where Tommy started. That's where Jersey Boys started.
Mm-hmm.
I think the revival of How to Succeed started out here too, because that was him as well.
Huh.
The 95 one with Matthew Broderick.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of work out here and there's a lot of opportunity out here. It's just a matter of equity figuring it out.
Like I'm pretty sure that Heather's started out here and it was, did Rocky Horror start in the American version? Did it start out here?
I believe so.
Yeah.
The LA cast was first and Reefer Madness.
I bet there's a lot of shows that had their roots in local LA theater that would not have happened under these new, equity rules for Los Angeles.
Yeah.
That's my main point, is that you don't know what's going to come out of Hollywood Fringe and turn into a Broadway production 3 years from now.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I mean, it's like if you look at an example of Six.
Yeah.
If Six had started in LA, would it have made it to off-Broadway? Maybe, but it's unlikelier.
Yeah.
I mean, it wouldn't certainly have gone, or would it have ever even gotten produced outside of a fringe here because of the costs and whatnot associated? Yeah.
And that show is like lowering costs about as much as you can.
Oh my God. Yeah. Yeah.
So
that'll put a button on our equity rant.
Well, we can put the button on our equity rant is that we did see an equity tour last week.
We did. Do you want to segue into that right now?
Sure.
Okay. I had a couple more things of news, but we'll get to them at the end.
Oh, yeah. Let's do it at the end. So we saw Falsettos at the Amundsen last week.
We did.
And this is a show that you did not like.
Oh, no. Did not like is an understatement. I hate this show. I'd never seen it before. I had never seen a staged production of it, but I'm very familiar with the recording,
mm-hmm.
very familiar with how much I'm supposed to love it.
Mm-hmm.
And I just never have.
Mm-hmm.
I find it exhausting. I find the characters unlikable. I find it, repetitive and tedious. Mm-hmm. I find it all kinds of things I don't like. However,
and now
I really liked this production.
Oh, good.
For the most part.
Yeah.
There were some problems, I thought, here and there, and there's the act one is still a bit much for me. Yeah. There's a lot of just neurosis and angst that I don't love.
There's one number in particular that should definitely be cut from act one, but you can't because it's the name, it contributes to the name of the show. So you probably get resistance from the William Finn and James Lapine to cut it, but it should be cut. Yeah, the March of the Falsettos. It's unbearable. It's inexplicable, and it wasn't even done in a fun way. That's what I also didn't get. Was like, but anyway, that should be cut. The rest of it was good.
yeah, I agree about that number. It just kind of felt like it came and left. And
that honestly feels like it has roots in like downtown New York theater of when the show was kind of edgier and sort of all over the place. And Act One, I believe, was written like 5 or 6 years before Act Two was written. It was originally 3 one-acts. And Act Two, which is what used to be Falsetto Land, feels way more mature as a piece of work.
Oh, my goodness, yeah. I mean, and I think that kind of works in that...
Yeah, it like
you're seeing the characters mature as well. Like,
right,
the writing is better. The characters are better.
The songs are better.
The songs are better. The plot is better. Like, it's clearer. Act two is just clearer. So the chaos of Act one can be viewed as not just the writing, but like the characters' lives are all in upheaval and everything is a mess.
Yeah.
So the writing reflects that, and then everything kind of streamlines and gets more clear.
Yeah.
In Act two,
This was directed by James Lapine.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought it was really brilliantly directed, and particularly, it had the feel of someone else coming in and reimagining it.
Yeah.
Cause I saw the original back in the day and it was fine, but like it had the energy of someone coming in being like, I've got a vision for this show.
I've got fresh eyes.
It's particularly impressive that he did it to his own work that he co-wrote.
Mm-hmm.
I thought the the staging and the set design and stuff was really interesting.
That giant kind of pieced block that became everything,
yeah,
I thought was really clever, and I loved the way they used it and how it broke apart and became different things and turned it upside down, and now it's a table. It was really, really clever.
Yeah.
And minimalist in a way that didn't seem minimalist.
Yeah.
You know, like, it didn't seem like there was a bare stage, but it kind of was.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just these pieces of this block that kind of...
Yeah, one thing I noticed, I've noticed a couple times at Pantages and Amundsen is, I feel like a lot of these theaters have too much headroom above the actors. Mm. So even in that, like, they've got the block, they've got some New York City skyline or something like that. But then there's like 50 feet of air between the top of an actor's head and the top of the proscenium that I wonder, I almost feel like it would be better if it was like a little jewel box look of a place. I don't
like
know.
bring the focus in a little bit more.
Cause it makes them look small a little bit. I just realized while you were talking about the block that the block is probably a metaphor for the family because of all the pieces fitting together.
Mm-hmm.
Cause at times not all the pieces are there.
That's beautiful.
And then it becomes a wood fired pizza oven. I thought the cast was good.
For the most part.
We saw a good kid. I liked his voice.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, I've seen falsettos with a terrible lead kid.
Mm-hmm.
This is my third time seeing this show.
Okay.
Third production seeing this show.
We should say that this is one of your favorite shows.
Falsetto Land is one of my favorite shows. First act of the show, I'm not as familiar with and don't love as much.
Okay.
But it does have some really good songs. I'm Breaking Down from Act One is one of my favorite comedic songs.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw the original with Michael Rupert.
Mm-hmm.
Stephen Bogardus, I have to figure out who I saw. I definitely didn't see Faith Prince, and I'm not sure that I saw Barbara Walsh. But I did see, okay, I think, most of the... because I'm not sure if she came back for that or not.
You may have seen Alison Fraser.
Maybe. And then I saw the National Asian American Theater Company in New York City.
Oh.
Did a production of Falsetto Land.
With Frances Jew? And...
Welly Yang was in it.
I remember this because I was cleaning out our garage and I found your playbill from it.
Oh, really?
So I was just looking through it. And I believe Frances Jew is in it, but also, who did we see in Soft Power? Was that Frances Jew?
No. Yeah, that is Frances Jew.
Yeah, he was in it.
Was he Mendel? He might have been Mendel.
I don't remember. I didn't.
Welly Yang. Do you know Welly Yang?
I don't.
He was a wizard. Anyway, that was a good production. Yeah, the original production was 1993.
That's the Broadway.
Yeah. I saw it on Broadway, I think, which is already a little bit into the life of the show because it existed as
the others.
Separate one acts. And then they put them all together to be falsettos.
Which was the first... Broadway was the first production of falsettos.
Right. And then... I think that's what I saw. And then I believe Mandy went into that run at some point.
He did. He replaced Michael Rippert.
So yeah, I did see. I'm pretty sure I did see. It is Barbara Walsh.
Who were the lesbians from next door?
The lesbians from next door were. Hold on one second. Oh, some interesting replacements. Carolee Carmello.
Okay, I was gonna say I thought Carolee was in it.
And Heather McRae.
Oh, Heather McRae.
Nice. And then, just want to give you some replacements here. Steven Cotell, that's a kid. Marvin, Greg Adelman.
Mm.
That would have been fun. Trina, Randy Graff.
I love
her. So you could have a little City of Angels. Were they both in City of Angels?
Uh-huh. And ooh. Greg Adelman is married to Carolee Carmello.
Oh. Well, look at that nepotism. Jason Gray.
Gra
was Mendel. Sean McDermott was a wizard.
Sean McDermott. That name sounds familiar.
Maureen Moore was a Cordelia.
I've heard of her.
And Mandy, as we said. Sal Viviano was I've a wizard.
Yeah.
And classic. I mean, when you think of who would play Marvin.
Oh, boy.
Absolutely perfect casting.
John Rubenstein.
Yeah. Not far off in terms of being a star in other mediums. Adrian Smed. Was the last wizard? Was the last Marvin?
Was a Marvin?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Adrian's Med?
Yeah.
That's so strange.
Very strange.
I can see him as a Whizzer, maybe.
Yeah, actually, yeah.
Not a Marvin.
Actually, the guy that we saw as Whizzer at Amundsen is not unlike Adrian's Med in his hair.
In
his, like, 70s. This Whizzer was very 70s open shirt swagger.
Yeah.
Stephen Bogardus was not like that.
I'm sure.
Stephen Bogardus was more like the handsome, hot, like 40-year-old gay guy.
Uh-huh.
Like he never seemed like a young buck.
Okay.
Whereas this guy was like walked off of Fire Island.
It was like Saturday Night Fever.
Right.
Yeah.
Was Stephen Bogardus in Love, Valor, Compassion? I think he was.
I think so.
I think around this time it seemed like there were like John Benjamin Hickey, John Glover. It seemed like there was like a little set of actors that were just in all the gay shows.
Right.
Like everything Terrence McNally and mm-hmm. this. And like, I just remember seeing like the same faces over and over.
Yeah.
In a lot of things.
I think at that point, especially because of the rise of the AIDS crisis, there were a lot of actors who were not willing to play gay.
Yeah.
Or were closeted and terrified of playing gay because they might be too good at it. And
yeah.
Somebody might suspect.
I'm sure that they wanted Nathan Lane to be Mendel in this. Although this is 93. How big of a star was Nathan Lane?
He won the Tony in 92.
For Guys and Dolls?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but instead, we have Chip Zion, who's
I love the Chip best. Zion. Speaking real quick, this is interesting, of that production of Guys and Dolls that Tony winners Faith Prince and Nathan Lane led, Joe Sullivan Lesser, who passed away this week, was instrumental in getting that revival to happen.
Oh.
I just thought that was a little interesting connection there.
It all comes full circle.
It does.
But overall, so, yeah, it's a great show, right?
Overall, I really enjoyed it much more. There were some... I felt like Marvin, who was Max von Essen, who I've enjoyed in other things before, felt very low energy in the first act.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was a character choice, but he felt... For a character that so passionately wants it all, as he keeps singing about it.
Right.
and also gets to the point where, I guess, spoiler alert, he slaps someone.
Yeah.
There didn't seem like any buildup to that. It didn't seem like there was a fire burning inside of him and that he was this passionate person. He just seemed very kind of cold. It felt to me, and I said this to you because he looks a little bit like Benjamin Walker on stage. It felt like I was watching American Psycho.
Well, you said that early.
Yeah.
What was weird was... And I was like, I guess I can see that. But what was weird was he kind of played it the same way Benjamin Walker played
just this Patrick kind of Bateman. Distance and chilly.
And so it was weird that you said that, because you said that early on kind of just based on how he looked.
And he looked, yeah.
And then it was like, oh, his approach to the character is very similar. And then he actually sang I Want It All, which is a line that Patrick Bateman sings in the opening number of American Psycho, in a very similar melody. And so when he sang that, I was like, wait, what's happening? I disagree with you when you said that he was low energy in Act 1. I do disagree with you because I think he was low energy in both acts.
I thought you were going to say that.
I mean, it's hard to gauge on tours. I would give the benefit of the doubt to the actor in that it's possible that you don't have a good sense of how it's playing in these gigantic tour houses. And that at this point on the tour, maybe there's not, you have a stage manager, but there's probably not a real strong artistic voice following the tour around going like, hey, it's not reading past the fifth row. But that's kind of how it felt.
So what you're saying is like what he thinks is a beautiful, intimate performance is not just not reading.
I think it's very possible. I'm sure that this show lends itself to people feeling like, let me try to play this, you know, the whole show has to revolve around me, and let me not sort of push too hard.
Mm-hmm.
Cause also I hate it when people push too hard. Like,
sure.
So
there's definitely a balance.
It might be a calibration issue, and maybe they've only got like a touring stage manager around to be like, it's fine.
Yeah.
And who's going to just send you an email with like, you messed up this word on this line.
Make sure you're in your light on this line.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although I will say, like, because you had mentioned the Jason, the child actor, and I felt like he was great in Act 1, and then I felt in Act 2 that he had, like, lost a lot of energy. And I had made the comment to you, I'm like, I wonder if he's modeling his act, because he's supposed to be much older, he's supposed to be, like, 3 years older in Act 2. I wonder if he's modeling his performance based on Max von Essen's, where he's kind of becoming his father. In which case, if that's the case, then it is a directorial thing.
I can't imagine that's what's happening, but it did seem like he was tired. But also, maybe, well, in the from the directorial point of view, maybe it's also that he's trying the same approach and it's similarly just not reading past a certain level. But then the counter argument to what I'm saying is that, like, almost everybody else was pretty was more forthcoming with their with sharing their voice and energy to the back of the house, you know.
Mm-hmm. And it's not like it's not like he doesn't have experience. He's got Broadway credits. He's done national. He was Sonny on the national tour of Xanadu, so he knows.
I wonder what if this is playing this the road is like. I wonder if this is early in their LA run. Like I
think so.
There must be an element for all the tours where when you sit down somewhere, you don't know the house very well till the end of the, you know, maybe this is an argument for me moving our tickets to the ends of runs.
Once you kind of,
but then the problem with the ends of runs is that people
get tired or
are tired and want to get out of that city.
Right.
And are ready to move on.
All right. We've been to Disneyland. It's time to go.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I should just expect people to be at their best on the night that I buy a ticket.
Yeah. It would be nice if they were all just giving 100% all the time. I will say the women who played the lesbians from next door were both fantastic.
Yeah.
Just huge, incredible.
Well, they're not tired.
Right?
They got a whole act of the show. They can show up at the theater at 9 p.m. and
I wonder if they have to do any ensemble singing at all. Like, to, you know how, like...
I don't think so.
I don't think so either, but I just wonder if any of the group members have, like, the two of them off stage.
If I was one of them, I'd be like, no, I'm not doing it. Or...
Evan Hansen, this stuff, you know, record...
Yeah,
record I would chorus.
No, I want to be backstage watching, you know, watching NBC's Superstore.
Oh, Thursdays at 9.
There
was one person that I was sadly disappointed in the cast.
Oh.
Only because I've seen her in other things and I've really enjoyed her in other things. But Eden Espinosa as Trina, was having I don't know if she was tired or if she was sick. It sounded a little bit like she might've been sick, but she was having some major, major pitch problems.
Maybe the whole cast is tired.
Maybe
because a lot of the things we're describing are like people that are tired.
Yeah. But I mean, like she was actively throwing off harmonies.
I mean, she wasn't actively sabotaging.
Mean that she did. Yeah, I didn't. That was the wrong word. But like, there were cringe-worthy moments where you were like, "Oh, you're just half a. Come on,
tough."
Like,
because there's a lot of
there's so much harmony too.
There's a lot of kind of close harmonies, and in that show, they kind of only show up when something is like emotionally delicate. Mm. They're not doing close harmonies the whole show.
Sure.
It's just like there'll be moments where it's like, you know, and the hard thing about William Finn is that there are some intentionally dissonant moments as well. So in Act One, I wasn't always sure where things were, like what was happening.
Because you're not as familiar with it.
Not as familiar with it. And I'd be like, well, I guess that could be this, or maybe that's a key change. A couple times I did think like, did they change keys there? But Act Two, which I know really well, there are some times where I was like, oh, boy.
Yeah.
But similar to you saying that maybe the kid modeled himself after the adult, maybe she modeled herself after Betty Buckley in Hello, Dolly. Oh. Because, but I do think it's a fatigue issue.
Yeah.
She has a very powerful voice.
Yeah.
You told me this beforehand, but afterwards I wouldn't have been surprised that she was Elphaba.
Yeah.
In Wicked, because she has the tone of like whatever that kind of rock wailing kind of thing is. And my theory was maybe when you sing like that, maybe it's harder to stay on pitch.
Yeah.
Because I believe other people that have sung like that in Wicked have had pitch issues.
Yeah. But I will say I saw Eden do Wicked well into her run and she was fine.
Uh-huh.
I think either she was tired or it's the damage that was done doing Wicked as long as she did it is now causing problems.
Yeah.
There were actresses who were in Wicked who
had pitch issues while they were in Wicked.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Like the original.
Uh-huh. Adele Dazeem.
Adele Dazeem, the fabulous Adele Dazeem, which I will say I was like, oh, that, cause I mean, Eden has always had a very distinct sound to me, but she sounded especially with the pitch problems, so much like Idina Menzel to me in this production. There were line readings. She sounded a lot like Idina.
Huh.
And I was kind of like, well, maybe just get Idina. It's a bigger name.
I'm sure they couldn't afford her.
Yeah,
for
I'm
this.
Sure too. But I wonder if they approached her for the Broadway production.
Oh, I'm sure they approach everybody for all these. You know, like I'm sure they were like, we want Idina to be next to Stephanie J. Block.
Yeah.
So in terms of draw, Idina would draw more than Stephanie J.
Far
Block.
Far more, yeah.
But
well, good.
And I think they had a pretty, as far as Broadway goes, pretty all-star cast.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. You know. Oh, definitely.
They just didn't have any Jewish people in it.
That's why. At least with if you got Idina, then you'd at least have one.
Yeah. I mean, I it's not my issue, so I don't necessarily care that much. And I didn't hear that much hubbub about it.
There was some.
But like, I don't know. It's crazy to me because that show is very Jewish in culture.
Uh-huh.
When I saw the Asian American Theater Company do it, they were doing it as a specifically like, there was a mission statement about that company particularly did shows that were basically like, we need to give more opportunity to Asian American actors.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to do like any play, doesn't matter what it is. And cast it with Asian actors. And I remember for Falsettos that they were like, we're drawing parallels between like Asian American families and Jewish families, like how tight knit the families are.
Uh-huh.
And we know that the there's like cultural things in here that aren't necessarily accurate. Although really any Asian person can be Jewish these days, especially with as many of us getting adopted.
Wow.
I mean, people want us as children.
Just not as adults.
Yes, not as adults. So what I'm saying is like, that show is very, it's not just like things that you can say, like probably in Merrily We Roll Along, maybe there's references to Jewish culture or Yiddish or something. It's sort of like a tangential thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or in some other, like, you know, it probably comes up as a side joke, or when they did Guys and Dolls with Faith Prince and Nathan Lane, when they do the
Sonu,
right? But it's not like Nathan Detroit's necessarily Jewish. It's just that he's like East Coast.
He's echoing things that he hears around him in the neighborhood.
But Falsetto is like about, like it, the first
it's
song
about
is,
Judaism.
The first song is four Jews in a room bitching.
Uh-huh. All of Act Two takes place about a bar mitzvah.
I mean, it's, so to then be like, well, we're putting like straight white dude that's not Jewish, Christian Borle, and white dude that's not Jewish as Whizzer,
mm-hmm.
Andrew Rannells, is a little bit like a fuck you to me.
Yeah, and there definitely was some clapback on it, but
probably not much, I guess.
Not enough, I don't think, to make a real ripple effect of it, but also it was met with, well, they're the best for the people for the role.
Well, it also speaks a little bit to that, like, it is not as much an impediment to be a Jewish actor as it is to be an Asian or a gay. Or like, yeah. there's, you know.
You can play non-Jewish.
But, or there's lots of work.
Yeah.
That for reflects Jewish culture in general.
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. So what were we talking about? You should go see. I would recommend this show.
Yeah.
There's a lot more tour cities coming up as far as I can tell.
Yeah. I think it's a very solid tour. I think it was well directed. I liked the show much more in practice. I mean, like in seeing it. It's one of those scores that it's honestly, there are other scores like Kiss of the Spider Woman. I can listen to a couple of songs from it, but I don't just sit and listen to it beginning to end.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause there's a lot of it that just is uninteresting to me on recording.
Right.
But when you see it, it works. So I guess that's kind of true of Falsettos as well. It's not a score that I would find pleasant to listen to,
mm-hmm.
but in seeing the whole show as a package, I enjoyed it.
So it's in LA till May 19th. Then it's sitting down in Chicago for May 28th to June 9th, Washington DC for 2 weeks, and then Charlotte, North Carolina for 5 days. And it looks like that's the end of the tour.
Yeah, and Eden is leaving soon.
What?
She's going to do Lizzie, the show that we saw a couple months ago here.
Interesting.
Off-Broadway, because she was one of the original cast members of that show.
Huh.
So she's leaving the tour. I don't know who's replacing her. One last thing I wanted to say about Eden. I enjoyed her I'm Breaking Down. I thought it was fun until I went after the show and watched Stephanie J. Block's version of it. And was like, oh, this is, and then you showed me Barbara Walsh's version of it. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So it, in the theater, it worked, but not when compared to some other versions of it.
I will also just say that if you're an actor, that's looking for a female comedic song for your book, I'm Breaking Down from, I think it's from March of the Falsettos is the chunk that it's from, should go in your book or work on it.
For a male?
No, wait. I said female.
I thought you said for a male looking for a female song. I was like, why would they
be doing
that?
I said if you're an actor. Okay. I said, oh, you got thrown off because I said actor.
Actor. Okay.
Which is what I always use.
Okay. Do you not say comedian anymore?
No, I don't.
I never did. I hate that.
I think that's it for this week.
Well, I had some more
news. Oh, let's hear some news.
Just real quick, I'm going to run down. The Revival of Oklahoma, which was met with very mixed reviews and very mixed audience reactions because of its kind of audacity and new take on the material, has extended into 2020. Hmm. So it's gotten a nice big extension, so there's much more chance to see it. The Broadway Cares, Equity Fights, AIDS kind of Easter bonnet celebration was last weekend. They do the Easter bonnet kind of follies where they all do with scenes and skits and songs and their bonnets. It's like the big spring push when they do the red buckets and you know, whatever. So they've raised this year $6,594,778. So bravo to them. Mm. The biggest fundraiser was the Ann Peggy tour of Hamilton, which raised $513,734. And Lin-Manuel surprised everybody by showing up to accept the award for that. Beetlejuice has just announced, Beetlejuice officially opened on Broadway. The reviews were not great.
I read the New York Times review.
Holy boy.
Which is about as, like, it's the harshest, like, non-harsh pan that I've read in a while.
Yeah.
Because it's basically, I think he might have written something similar for SpongeBob, where it's basically like, I guess you'll enjoy it. It's got a lot of jokes in it. Some of them are good, some of them are awful, and it's just basically saying, like, it's going to assault you with its brand of theater and comedy for the entire time, and it's basically like, that's not necessarily a good thing.
Right.
But it's very positive towards Alex Brightman.
Mm-hmm. The score seems to be getting the biggest hit of it. The score, it's also the same composer who wrote the songs for King Kong. So he's got two shows that opened in the same season on Broadway that were both panned as far as his score goes. And he's a relatively new writer, so it's interesting. But they've just announced Beetlejuice and Hadestown will be getting original Broadway cast recordings. So that's exciting, because Hadestown we weren't sure was going to get one because they had
they have like a couple concept albums or something.
Yeah. And a lot of some of the cast members who are in the Broadway cast are on those albums, so sometimes it's like, well, we don't need to re-record it for these two people, but they are going to. Noah Galvin from the TV show The Real O'Neills, who was the second Evan Hansen and Dear Evan Hansen, is returning to Broadway today. He starts in Waitress as Ogie, which I think is interesting casting, because he's casting. Really young to be playing that. And then the only other things I have are some upcoming cast recording release dates. The Be More Chill Broadway cast recording is going to get a digital release on May 3rd. So that's next week. There's no word on a physical CD release. A lot of them are just doing digital releases now.
Yeah.
The Cher show has already had its digital release. I got the recording. It came out on April 12th, but the CD physical release will be May 10th. And Hadestown, the digital release is June 7th. The CD release is to be determined.
So wait, they haven't recorded yet, but they've got the release date already?
Seems so.
Oh.
Or they've already recorded, and they just announced that they were doing it.
Oh, okay. Because if they haven't recorded and they want to release it on June 7th, that's pretty soon.
That's tight, yeah.
I mean, that, well,
5 weeks.
Because we've talked before about, like, the idea of, like, coming on a Monday and just record the album is a great way to get a mediocre cast recording.
Yeah.
The gold standard, of course, is Hamilton, which, like, they recorded as if it was, like, a real album. The Roots produced it, like, you know, and it pretty much, like, you can't say that it didn't succeed as a cast recording.
Right.
So for other shows to then come in and be like, I'd just be, if they haven't recorded Hazy's Town and they're releasing on June 7th, that means they're just going to come in and do a one day thing.
They might also be, I don't know.
But they're pretty rushed for if they're treating it as a full album, that's a very rushed timeline.
Well, what I'm saying is they might be doing a live in theater recording. So a lot of shows will like live on stage, or do a live recording, which requires maybe less.
Right. But that's still not going to produce a great cast recording that sells the show to people that aren't in New York that can't see the show, which is what the Hamilton cast recording did.
Yeah.
Whereas even, for example, something like the Evan Hansen cast recording is good, but I don't know what they could have. I think they might have wanted to add some dialogue scenes to it or whatever, because it so doesn't create the context of those songs.
Right.
That I don't necessarily think you really know the show from the cast recording.
Sure.
In the way that you do with Hamilton.
Yeah.
It also just depends, because Hamilton's so sung through.
Right.
But anyway,
Go
check out Falsettos. Next week, tomorrow night, we're seeing Fiddler on the Roof here in Los Angeles. We'll talk about that next week. And you need to catch up on your Fosse Verdon if you haven't, because we're going to be talking about that another couple of episodes at some point.
Yep.
Cool.
Bye.
Bye.
It's Open Call with Eric and Chris.
That's me.
It's a show that you'll never want to miss. It's Open Call.